Volunteer Coordinator Adrian Rainey at 608-321-9583 or head online to WORTFM.org/volunteer to fill out an application. Labor Radio, a voice for workers.
Hello, this is Julie Candler with the BBC News. U.S. government officials say the container ship which crashed into a bridge in Baltimore warned of a possible collision after losing power on leaving port. Speaking at the White House, President Biden has promised to send all federal resources necessary to help with the situation in Baltimore. He said officials believed eight people were still unaccounted for and the search and rescue operation continued to be a top priority.
Everything so far indicates that this was a terrible accident. At this time, we have no other indication, no other reason to believe there's any intentional act here. Personnel on board the ship were able to alert the Maryland Department of Transportation that they had lost control of their vessel, as you all know and reported. As a result, local authorities were able to close the bridge to traffic before the bridge was struck, which undoubtedly saved lives.
The U.S. Supreme Court appears unlikely to restrict access to the widely used abortion drug mifepristone. At a hearing, a majority of justices expressed skepticism about the arguments presented by anti-abortion groups. The Biden administration is appealing against a lower court ruling that would limit how the medication is prescribed and distributed. A United Nations expert has told the UN Human Rights Council she believes Israel's military offensive in Gaza amounts to genocide. Presenting a new report, Francesca Albanese, who's the special expert on the occupied territories, said the threshold indicating genocide against Palestinians in Gaza had been met.
The genocide in Gaza is the most extreme stage of a long-standing settler colonial process of erasure of the native Palestinians. For over 76 years, this process has oppressed the Palestinians as a people in every way imaginable, crushing their inalienable right to self-determination demographically, economically, territorially, culturally, and politically. Israel has attempted to displace them, expropriate their land and other resources, and ultimately replace them.
The Director General of the BBC, Tim Davie, has called for talks with the British government, urging it to again fund the World Service directly. David Sillitoe reports.
The BBC's current charter will come to an end in just over 3 years' time, and Tim Davie today laid out his vision for the corporation's future. He talked about the need for the BBC in a global media environment dominated by American and Chinese tech companies, increasingly switching funding from traditional TV schedules to the BBC streaming services, and asking the government to once again pay for the world's service. The BBC's income was effectively cut by around 30% between 2010 and 2020, and around 1,000 hours of output have already been cut, and the ongoing savings plan is to be increased to reduce spending by around £700 million a year by 2028.
World News from the BBC. Shares in Donald Trump's social media company have soared after they made their debut on New York's Nasdaq exchange. The value of a single share in the firm, which owns the platform Truth Social, rose by about 50% in early trading before falling back. Mr. Trump stands to make billions of dollars. A White House official has said the administration is deeply concerned that the Venezuelan opposition candidate Corina Yoris had not been allowed to register for elections in July. A National Security Council spokesperson urged President Nicolas Maduro to let all candidates run against him, adding that the U.S. was committed to maintaining sanctions relief if Mr. Maduro upheld his commitment to hold credible elections. The medical charity MSF has warned of outbreaks of measles in South Sudan and Yemen. It said that there had been seven deaths and more than 450 cases among children under five since February in South Sudan's western Equatorial state. Indonesia has started a search for evidence that the Javan tiger, thought to have been made extinct by hunters in the 1980s, might actually still exist in the wild. Here's Celia Hatton.
The investigation was launched after scientists discovered genetic traces of a Javan tiger on a single hare found near a village in western Java in 2019. At the time, a villager had spotted what he thought was a Javan tiger with its distinctive long, narrow face jumping from a fence. The hare was later found on the fence and large paw prints and claw marks beneath. Conservationists will now use camera traps on Java Island in hopes of confirming the Javan tiger's survival, though they also expressed worries about publicizing their search for fear it would attract hunters.
BBC News.
You wake up to the 8 o'clock buzz to get the week started.
Now, we need the help of a good volunteer to run our on-air operations each Monday.
Sure, that means waking up a little earlier.
To get to the station around 7:30.
But that's why WORT has coffee.
So that you can start your week off right.
WORT is recruiting a volunteer to run the soundboard each week on Monday mornings from 7:30 to 9 a.m.
You'd run all on-air operations for our morning program, The 8 O'Clock Buzz with Brian Standing.
No experience is necessary, but a familiarity with computers and a strong sense of punctuality and reliability are preferred.
For details, call 608-256-2001 and ask to speak with Shali Pittman.
Or head online to wortfm.org/volunteer to fill out our volunteer application.
6'6" above sea level. I grab my mic because I like to take it to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground. We bring the truth to places.
And welcome. Welcome to one and all. Welcome to WORT's Community Conversation, a public affair, coming to you on Tuesday, March 26th, 2024. I'm your guest host, Bert Zipper, filling in for Ali today. And it is my distinct pleasure to welcome Austin Frerich to the show. Austin, welcome to WORT.
Thanks for having me on, Bert.
Austin has written the book Barons, Money, Power, and the Corruption of America's Food Industry. It's actually being released today, published by Island Press. He will be in person at Leopold's bookstore on Regent Street. We will link to that on our website. Leopold's is in the old Greenbush Bakery, right across from the new Greenbush Bakery. So Austin was also, let me talk about Austin for a minute, and then we're going to turn it over to Austin. Austin was the first writer in residence of the Wisconsin Farmers Union up in Chippewa Falls, and that really was a writer in residence. They have apartments above their offices, so he was living there for a while. Austin Frerich is an expert on agricultural and antitrust policy. He worked at the Open Markets Institute, U.S. Department of Treasury, and the Congressional Research Service before becoming a fellow at Yale University. Much like myself in Wisconsin, he is a seventh-generation Iowan from Cedar Rapids, Iowa, and a first-generation college graduate, again like me, with degrees from Grinnell College and the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Let me read a couple of things that people have written about you, Eric, or Austin. First by Eric Schlosser. Austin Frerich is an ideal author to tell this story. He possesses a deep understanding of antitrust policy and agricultural economics. He has learned the names and the faces behind these supposedly irrational and impartial corporations. More important, he has a personal stake in the outcome. He's seen firsthand the impact of our industrial food system upon his home state of Iowa. He's witnessed the hollowing out of rural towns in the Midwest, the sickening pollution from factory farms, the inchoate anger and political extremism that stem from growing inequality. He knows that nothing less than our democracy is now at stake. And in Austin's own words from the book, first, we need to understand how we arrived where we are today. Power does not disperse organically. We have an opportunity to turn the corner and build a more balanced food system, but only if we challenge power directly. Austin, welcome to WORT.
Thank you. I mean, that Eric quote means so much to me because I feel like everyone has that book they read when they're growing up that really shapes them, like the first adult book. And Fast Food Nation was the book that did it for me. I read it between shifts at a sub sandwich shop I worked at in high school.
Oh.
And to have Eric write my foreword, it's just such an honor.
Oh, that's a great story. And here you are today. Now, this is your first book, but you've written a lot of other stuff before this.
Yeah. So, I mean, I published in various news outlets the last few years, and a lot of it is just ideas I've been workshopping for this book. Like one was, I just had this hunch that we've offshored the American produce system. And I first noticed it in an article in the Christian Science Monitor like 10, 15 years ago, where they mentioned just offhand how 70% of the apple juice in America comes from China. And that just blew my mind. And you sit there and think about it, and you're like, huh, what's going on here? I mean, right. Most of the apple orchards I grew up with are gone. But also, you're like, oh, the biggest cost of production for apples is labor. So for some reason, it's cheaper to pay someone to pick an apple in China and ship that liquid across the world. And so I workshopped this idea actually in the American Conservative. I published an article on this, and then that whole framework became part of my Driscoll Barron chapter, because that I really want to talk about that story, because I don't feel like that story's been really told in this moment we're living in.
Exactly. You know, I noted that Publishers Weekly has listed your book among a small group for this year as a must read. So for our listeners, you get a chance to talk right with the author here before you go out and you buy the book. Let's talk about those seven food markets that you detail the barons of: hogs, grain, coffee, dairy, berries, slaughtering and meat, as well as grocery. Talk about the overview of all this. How did you come to this?
Yeah, so I mean, I originally came to this idea. It was originally, honestly, it's like most it started in a bar. I was just BSing with a political operative in 2018, the summer, and he was telling me the largest political donor in Iowa is this hog farmer. And for context, Iowa doesn't have campaign contribution limits for state level campaigns. And Iowa had a very, very contentious governor's race that year. This hog guy had given over $300,000 to the governor for her reelection campaign. And he was telling me how not only does he live in the only gated community in Iowa, but he has a private jet, supposedly with the words "when pigs fly" written on it, that he flies back and forth to a home in Florida. And for me, it's like, first of all, that's good copy. But second, it's like, what a fascinating story. Like, what a symbolism of what happened to Iowa. And so like, I just dove into it. I co-wrote an article in Vox magazine with my buddy, Charlie Mitchell, to kind of what is going on here, tell this bigger story, like, using this kind of robber baron framework to tell this. And I realized after publishing the article, it's like, oh, what I see in hogs, you see this across the food system. So we can take this framework of robber barons and tell these bigger food stories. Because for me, every robber baron, I'm using their stories to tell bigger structural stories. Like, it's not just, this book is not just the lifestyles of the rich and famous.
Right.
I want to talk about the farm bill, but I'm going to use it through the story of Cargill.
And then you also lead us to, this is what we can do and must do in this democratic society to build a better future. You pointed out yesterday as we were talking that you don't want to say the system is broken, because that implies it was working really well at one point.
Yeah, I mean, that was something, the curse and beauty of working on a book for 5 years is, I mean, 5 years is a lot of time, mm-hmm. but it really allows you to really marinate with ideas. And the first section I really wrote was the Cargill Farm Bill history. And the BLM movement really shaped me there, really kind of opened my eyes to things where so much of this history is like, who tells the history? Mm-hmm. And so much of this history of farm agriculture in America is written by old, you know, guys that look like me at Iowa State. So you have this whole current of like black farmers in the South, like those stories missing. Mm-hmm. I realized I wasn't telling that story in the New Deal. And I also just, so I kind of added that to my book of like, okay, like, yes, there's some great things in New Deal, but it was very much good stuff for white farmers, not for black farmers.
Exactly, exactly.
And then on top of it, I just kind of came to this notion that I don't want to over-romanticize the past. I mean, there's things to borrow from the past, great lessons, but like, we're transitioning to a multicultural democracy. I mean, let's look forward and, you know, not romanticize 1950s America.
Exactly. And I noted in your book that you do have a wonderful sense of racial justice. You talk about where the land came from before the Homestead Act and the genocide and displacement of Native nations. You talk about the effect of black farmers of the New Deal. So thank you for that. That was very insightful. I want to invite callers. So if you're listening, 608-256-2001 will help you connect with us and join the conversation here. And that includes Storman and Dennis and Pete and Phil and all you guys out there. Call whenever you're ready. Let's talk about that Cargill chapter, Austin. Mm-hmm. What do people need to know? There's so much to talk about. I felt like I was getting so much, and I was so infuriated because I grew up in a small town like yourself. surrounded by farmers and farms. We had a small cheese factory. And I have a great anger for what happened to them. And your book was just full of great honoring of them as well as fury at what happened. So talk about Carr.
Yeah. So let me read you one of my favorite nuggets of research I found.
Okay.
And this is from a Cargill brochure.
Okay.
To quote Cargill, quote, "We are the flour in your bread, the wheat in your noodles, the salt on your fries. We are the corn on your tortillas, the chocolate in your dessert, the sweetener in your soft drink. We are the oil in your salad dressing and the beef and pork or chicken you eat for dinner. We are the cotton in your clothing and the backing of your carpet and the fertilizer in your field."
That's incredible, isn't it?
Wow.
That's incredible. And it's true.
Yep. That is Cargill. I mean, to be honest with you, Cargill wasn't my original book proposal when I put this together. Mm-hmm. It's an older book called Merchants of Doubt that kind of tipped me off first. Okay, what's going on with Cargill? It's an old book on the grain industry. And I started just kind of poking around and I realized, oh, Cargill's always been there. It's like, it's just like hidden in the distance. Mm-hmm. And then you start digging, you're like, wait, they're the largest private company in America. They are bigger than the Koch brothers. And just kind of, I mean, I find that fascinating. And then the way I frame this chapter is, they are the closest thing we have to a modern day Standard Oil in America. Like,
yes.
Their whole thing is about owning the rails. Like, they want to own the middle from the second that grain comes out of the ground until whatever that final grain product is on your plate. That is what they care. I mean, they own that. And even like, I conclude that chapter where I even kind of take it a step further where they really remind me of like the 19th century British Empire.
Yes.
And that, like, the grain never sets on Cargill's empire. I mean, when we see examples of their power, it's incredibly dark and scary in that chapter, but there's so much we don't know because it's private, because they're incredibly secretive. I mean, to mm-hmm. me, that's why they've been such a successful monopolist, because they tend to use middlemen. I noticed in my research where they never do things overtly like the Koch brothers. They give money to like the American Meat Association, who then do their bidding, because they're big in meat packing. Like, it's really brilliant and really scary because you just don't know who's financing what anymore. And so mm-hmm. it's a really effective, incredible way to manipulate the media.
You mentioned that of the world's grain, the planet Earth's grain, about 1/4 of it goes through Cargill.
Yes.
And that's a company we don't know much about, and imagine what we don't know. Thank you. Wow.
Yeah. And that's a company that started literally 13 miles down the street from where my Irish ancestors lived in Iowa. Like, that to me was the most wild part, is just that. I mean, and then the way they grew their empire, I mean, is, you have to keep in mind, I mean, so much of their story too is not just awing at their power, but like right. how they captured the farm bill.
Like, well, and let's talk
they
about
all that. Like, care. Yeah.
Let's talk okay. about that farm bill. Yes.
So the whole history of the farm bill comes out of, you know, the New Deal, where in response to the Dust Bowl, where you had oversupplied markets, and because of, you know, farmers to keep their land, they're pushing their land, overproducing even more, creating this massive environmental catastrophe. So USDA stepped in and they created a program, supply management, or basically kind of like a checks and balance, where sure, you'll get subsidies, but you have to take land out of production. Like, these things were interlocking, and it was all about stabilizing incomes and not, and like trying to find that sweet spot, like a Goldilocks kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then Cargill hated it. I tell that story how, I mean, this family, because they move grains, they want to move as their empire is rooted in grains, refining grains, processing grains, what have you. They hated that because this system was originally a tax on processors to pay for it. Well, you're limiting supply. Cargill doesn't like that. So it fought the New Deal Farm Bill from day one, because it wants to overproduce grains. It wants to move as much grain as possible. So then I tell this story of the Farm Bill, how basically the corporate capture of the Farm Bill to what I call the Wall Street Farm Bill, which to me is epitomized the 1996 Farm Bill, where that kind of system of supply management really collapses. And now it's massive subsidies to overproduce a few things, mainly grains, for the benefit of Cargill. And then the second part of that chapter is really about what are the consequences of this overproduction of grains at the expense of everything else, like the obesity crisis in America, all this kind of stuff.
Absolutely. And you point out that President Bill Clinton signed that Wall Street Farm Bill just a few months before he signed bills to end support for...
You got child welfare.
Yes, exactly.
No, that is one of my... there's certain people you get angry with when you write this book, and there's certain people. I mean, on the flip, let me just say on the flip side of Bill Clinton. At the same time, too, you had senators like Tom Harkin of Iowa fighting him, telling him not to do it.
Thanks to Tom.
So, like, yeah, I mean, people like Tom Harkin try to speak truth to power. I mean, I reference this speech Tom Harkin gave in Grinnell, Iowa, in the 80s during the farm crisis, just like really attacking corporate power even back then.
We are talking with Austin Frerich, the author of Barrons, talking about the U.S. food markets. And we'd like to invite you to call 608-256-2001 and join the conversation. The book is being released today. Austin will be in town a week from today at Leopold's at 6 o'clock next Tuesday night. So there you have it. Austin Frerich, back to you. Yeah, there are some people I got really angry at in just reading the book. Bill Clinton would be one. Tom Vilsack, the former governor, the supposedly the good governor of Iowa, he shows up very regularly in your book.
Yeah. That's, and I've gotten some pushback on that in Iowa. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's, Tom Vilsack was a hard one to write about. I really liked him as governor of Iowa back in the day. Mm-hmm. He did a really cool program called Vision Iowa, forever changed places like Dubuque. But, you know, people like Earl Butz were very transparent. They told you, get out.
Earl Butz, they were never. Let's back up. Who's Earl Butz?
When people talk about the corporate capture of the farm bill system, Earl Butz's name comes up a lot. He was Secretary of Agriculture under Nixon. He really pushed the corporate consolidation of the food system. But here's the thing. He was just a protege of Benson. I think Benson's his name under Eisenhower.
Yeah.
These people never, most Republican secretaries of agriculture never pretend to be the, you know, friends of farm. I mean, Sonny Perdue said that in Madison. He said that basically, effectively the same thing, get big or get out. But Vilsack is really dangerous, and here's why. He pretends to be on your side. And so, like, the example I really focus in on in the book are two things. One is the 2002 governor's, his campaign for re-election in Iowa.
Mm-hmm.
At this time, you had this rural revolt in Iowa against industrial hog facilities, just because the pollution, they're driving family farms out of business, just, there's these also awful pollution factories. And so you have gyms and small town gyms in Iowa being packed. He really harnessed that. And he ran against the head lobbyist for my hog baron. There were TV ads across Iowa about this. He promised to do something. And the way Iowa works is only the governor of Iowa can stop the construction of these hog manure facilities. And so after he won, not only did he not do anything, he oversaw the largest expansion of confinement hogs in Iowa history. His word means nothing.
Yeah.
And that just breaks people's spirits when they think, you know, I mean, you do all this activism, you galvanize people, and the person I think they're on their side just twists the knives in their back.
Yeah.
And then the anger I have a lot for him is in my Slaughtering Baron chapter. I talk about meat monopolies, JBS, how the biggest meat company we've ever seen in the world,
mm-hmm.
and how we're back in the air of the jungle. And it's funny, when I read that chapter, I'm not even angry with them. I mean, to me, they're carnage. They make a mockery of the system. The mm-hmm. fact that they basically, I tell the story how they bribed their way to monopoly level status. They bribed over 1,800 Brazilian politicians to get cheap money to buy a bunch of companies. And then we let them keep their monopoly.
Mm-hmm.
The story of them is like they keep pushing the envelope. And the problem is people like Vilsack don't punish them. It's just a slap on the wrist, slap on the wrist, slap on the wrist. And then you have this moment in the last few years in America where people are demanding reforms of the meat markets, from the price gouging in the store to, you know, cattle farmers being given the short change, to the workers being exploited during COVID, kids working in them. And not like he doesn't do anything. He doesn't, like, not only does he not do anything, the markets have gotten more concentrated these last 4 years under his watch.
Exactly.
And JBS bought a company, Tyson's bought a company, Walmart's making a massive play into beef packing right now. And it's just like, but he's doing all these press releases saying how much he's doing stuff, but he's not doing anything of substance. And it's just, I've never seen someone, it's like the worst combination of corruption and incompetency I've seen.
Well said. I want to quote from your book, Austin Frerich. You say, any multinational corporations co-opted the alternative system. Any solution to these problems that does not directly challenge power is doomed to failure. We must challenge the power directly. Can you talk about that for a second?
Yeah, I just think, to me, that's a rejection of this whole, there are certain writers that say change the system with your fork. And I just think that all that does is bifurcate the food system. And so much of the food reform movement has been centered on making better food for the whole foods consumer. Mm-hmm. And I just, it's so clear. I mean, yesterday was announced or earlier this week, Chick-fil-A is rolling back the antibiotic. I mean, they promise they wouldn't use antibiotics and it's chicken. It's rolling it back. What you tend to see happen in the food system too is new companies come along, they do stuff better. Nyman Ranch is an example. It's a pork company that does pasture pork. Then what happens, you know, big company buys it and it becomes just a niche thing. And then they slowly, honestly, they cut the corners of the brand. So the values that made it special no longer make it special or kind of, and it's just, you don't change a system that way. I mean, that to me is like really inherently like ingrained in me at this point. And that's why I like the meatpacking stuff with Vilsack is so frustrating, is we know what to do here. We did this stuff a century ago. This is not rocket science. To me, it's just, it's an inability to be a public servant.
Exactly. We've got two callers who are waiting in line to talk with you. And I'd like to welcome Patty Pelt, the great Patty Pelteco, to WORT. Patty, welcome.
Well, Bert, thank you so much. And hi.
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 Hey, Patty.
Hi, Austin. So, Austin, to return to talking about Earl Butz, do you see any indication or glimmer of hope that we are possibly nearing the end of Get Big or Get Out? And I say that knowing that here in Wisconsin, we have multiple confined animal feeding operations that have consolidated dairy production and to some extent beef and poultry production. So I know that we do have these giant factory farms. So I'm not so certain that we're reaching the end of Get Big or Get Out, but I want your take on that. And I'd also like you, if you can address this at all, to talk about how land ownership in the United States, particularly farmland, is now also being consolidated by robber barons, like people including Bill Gates, who I believe is now America's largest owner of agricultural land. Bill Gates, he's not a farmer. So those are my questions to you. And thank you so much for taking the call.
Yeah, thanks for calling, Patty. So to your question about hope, I actually, weirdly, I'm not even joking when I say this. I actually have a lot of hope right now. And it's because I'm a big believer in things always get dark before, you know, the light comes out. And the two things I see on the horizon, one is just is economics and reality, where ethanol is going to die. Cars are moving to electric batteries, hybrids. But that's going to kill ethanol. I mean, the single largest use of corn now in America is ethanol. And that transition from the American car fleet from gasoline to EVs, what have you, is going to happen fast. And so that whole market will crater. I mean, the industry, if you read between the lines, industry is freaking out. I mean, they're pushing the Biden administration, and Vilsack's giving them what they want a little bit here. But they're trying to put ethanol on their airplanes. I mean, it's just a farce. I mean, I briefly mentioned ethanol in my book. The conversation over ethanol is over. It's not good for the climate. There's a reason why the Museum of Failure put it in. And then, so that to me is like the hope is as ethanol dies, we put animal back on the land. Because what are you going to do with that land? And the second thing is, I actually think the farm bill, the modern day farm bill is breaking apart in front of us in this really cool bipartisan way where, I mean, the Republican Party, I mean, they can't pass it. I mean, everything I'm hearing is they want to try to pass it in the lame duck. But I don't think that's even going to happen because it's getting so bloated. I mean, you have heritage Republicans are just done with it. Because, I mean, crop insurance is such a corporate giveaway at this point. I think a really unique coalition could be formed to basically junk the farm bill as we know it. I mean, I'm not talking about food assistance. That's a whole different thing. But like that crop insurance commodity conservation thing, it's just so corrupted. And like the dirty secret is industry hollowed out its voter base. What used to be 20 farm families on the street now are, you know, one robber baron and, you know, 19 low wage workers for the robber baron. So that's kind of what gives me hope is like, I think the system is breaking down. And the key thing here is what do we do from here? And I also should say, based on my conversation with people, is people crave a positive vision right now. And the notion of animals back on the land to me, it's been one of the most bipartisan things I've seen recently. So put a pin on that. And then to your point, your question on land ownership, I totally agree with you. I think that is so huge. I'm a big believer in just tying farm bill stuff to, you have to work your land to get the farm bill stuff. I mean, how simple is that? I mean, the thing that blows people's mind is that most farmland in Iowa is owned by non-Iowans now. Grandma got to die, kids moved to California, they put in a trust. First of all, you can always tell when you're driving which land's being rented and which is not, because the people that rent the land usually are, you know, they're farming right up to the creek. But yeah, you're talking about the massive consolidation. You know, Bill Gates isn't farming that land. He's just a feudal lord. So I think tackling that is huge, but also you're seeing pushback on that. So I'm actually more hopeful than you, but we have to fight for it. I mean, it's as simple as that.
Thank you, Austin. We're talking to Austin Frerich, the author of Barrons, Money, Power, and the Corruption of America's Food Industry, released today. And the next caller is Pete Hardin, who's the publisher and the genius behind the great dairy newspaper, Milkweed, and a good friend. Pete, welcome to WRT.
Good to be here, and I'm not sure about that genius part. I'll let that pass. First of all, I'd like to express to the readers that Austin is, in terms of surfing analogy, he is at the crest of one of the biggest waves, economic waves in this country, i.e., food inflation, high food costs, the reasons behind high food costs, i.e., the concentration that he mirrors in his book. Back in early December, there was released a public opinion poll that found Americans' single biggest concern was food cost inflation. And chapter by chapter, Austin walks us through many of those reasons, which are man-made as opposed to nature's challenges. So, Austin, I'd like you to dig a little deeper into a couple chapters of your book. A, in the Walmart chapter, would you describe their market share in grocery compared to the competition? And also put a little context on this most recent Federal Trade Commission report that came out last week. And then secondly, just quickly profile Iowa's surface water quality issues, given all the hog manure and hog CAFOs.
Those are great questions, yeah. Pete.
Well, let me first start by saying to your listeners out there, I adore Pete. I mean, there's certain people, they've had his question about hope. A big thing I have with this book is there's a lot of good people out there doing really incredible things. You just have a few greedy people holding us back. And there's people like Pete where I just downloaded his brain. I mean, Pete is America's dairy expert. I put together a conference at Yale Law School on monopolies in the food system, and he did one on milk stuff. And it was one of the home run papers that people talked about, where one company has an 85% share of the fluid milk market on the East Coast, tri-state area, and New Jersey. So I'm forever grateful to Pete. I also probably called him dozens of times writing this book, picking his brain on. No joke, I find dairy policy to be some of the most complicated stuff out there. But to your question about Walmart, Pete, is so for the listeners out there, Walmart's market share in grocery is the same as the second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, and seventh combined. They sell 1 in 3 groceries. I mean, we've never seen a company this powerful in the food system in the history of the world. They are the king of kings. I even toyed with this idea writing this chapter of like, they're the closest thing we've ever had to a Politburo in America, like the Soviet Union style Politburo that dictated the economy. Because I kept hearing from people that I would talk to in the grocery business that with Walmart, it's supply and command.
Supply and command.
They shape your food. Yes. Wow. They tell people what to do. Yep. What Walmart wants, Walmart gets. And then with this, you just see massive consolidation. With consolidation, I mean, it's Monopoly 101. You see price fixing, price gouging. Industry loves to say, you know, cheap food. We need to have this destructive model because of cheap food. And that's just not correct. You actually pulled USDA's own figures. Italians spend as much on food as we do. And is anyone that's ever been to Italy, that food is way better for you, way tastier. And then most countries spend less on food than we do. So it's just, we're paying more and more for garbage. I mean, that's like the underappreciated thing too, of these robber barons is they don't make good tasting product. You know, you take industrial hog bacon and you have a normal, the way we used to do bacon, it's so much different. I think that's huge. And I actually think that's why this is really bipartisan, especially beef packing. I mean, if there's anyone that's being really shortchanged right now, it's the rancher, where Americans are seeing, you know, record beef prices in the store, but the rancher's not getting that. It's all being captured by my beef baron, JBS, slaughtering baron. But then also Walmart's making aggressive play into beef production right now. So, you know, you have that. To the FTC report, thanks for bringing that up, Pete. So to the listeners, earlier last week, the Federal Trade Commission released a report on just all the shenanigans the grocery industry pulled during COVID, especially the big ones, how they use their market power to reinforce their market power and undermine your local grocery store. Walmart did this a lot. I talked about this in the chapter where they basically tell their suppliers, you know, if you don't fulfill 98% of your orders on time, we're going to ding you. So that basically what it does is it makes suppliers prioritize Walmart and everyone else. And it's just like this, it's abuse of power. That's all it is. It's abuse of market power. It's going back to that supply and command. I mean, my one little favorite example of Walmart's power isn't, Bird and I were talking about this yesterday, is that Walmart has a rule for its suppliers that no more than 30% of your sales can come from Walmart. I have never heard of this before in the food industry. I couldn't understand it, but I was talking to grocery people. They were telling me it's for risk management for their supply chain. Walmart knows it's such a vulture that you need to get 70% of your sales elsewhere to keep you in business. So it basically wants you on life support, but doesn't want to kill you. And then to Pete's other question about the water crisis in Iowa, I mean, that to me is like one of the effects of this corporate greed, of this robber baron system is, you know, it kind of depends on the year, but like 2/3 of the waterways in Iowa are just too polluted to go into. And it happened slowly. I mean, I honestly didn't even realize this until my husband pointed it out to me, because he's not from Iowa. He's like, that's really weird that you can't, on the news on the summer at night, there's just a list of all the beaches are closed because the water is too dirty. Mm-hmm. And so that to me is like, we're paying the cost of his greed, his pollution. I mean, that is like the burden shifted to us. I mean, even for the hog industry in Iowa, like you have 25 million hogs. These hogs defecate 3 times more than a human being. So that's manure of 75 million people. You have the governor's basically hollowed out the regulatory system, the DNR that oversees the system. So it's a free for all. So you have the manure that's equivalent to the populations of California and Texas being not regulated hardly at all. You have manure spills happen into the water. And keep in mind, I'm just talking about hogs. I'm not even talking about the eggs in Iowa, the chickens, the industrial dairies, the beef, all the low-dose poison and fossil fuels used in feed for these animals that now live indoors. And so it's just like, and then on top of it, I think the biggest thing in Iowa right now, and it's going to only get worse, is Iowa is now has the second highest cancer rate in the nation. And it's going up. And the only solution they can talk about in Des Moines right now is increasing the age of increasing the tax on tanning beds. It's so clearly tied to this agricultural model. That is like the consequence of this, is these robber barons, they get all the, you know, they take all the wealth and leave us with all the consequences.
Exactly. Pete, did you have a follow-up question? Are you still there?
Nope. I keep going, Austin. You're doing great. Thank you.
For your listeners out there, I highly recommend subscribing to Pete's Milkweed News publication. I love reading it. You will learn so many great little tidbits.
And there is a full page review of this book by Austin Frerich on the back cover, on the back of the newspaper of the Milkweed this month. We're talking with Austin Frerich, author of Barons, Money, Power, and the Corruption of America's Food Industry, released today. Austin, talk about digesters and talk about methane and CO2. I learned about cow manure and the difference between industrial versus traditional cows. Talk about that, please.
Yeah. So when I was putting this book together, I really wanted to talk about these things called checkoffs. No one really knows what they are, but to me, they are everything in controlling the agriculture, the food system in America. They're basically puppets for the robber barons. So what's a checkoff? It's basically a tax on producers to help sell their good. They go back to the New Deal. Florida citrus originally created it. You know, it was drinking more Florida orange juice. these things weren't really anything. They were around, but the 80s is when they really started changing. And that wasn't related to this Wall Street Farm Bill of, we're going to overproduce a few things. We got too much of stuff. So the goal of a checkoff is to get you to eat more ice cream. You know what I mean? Get you to consume more of things. There's 20 or 30 of them in the country. Most of them are still small. There's a popcorn one, a Christmas tree one, what have you. But the meat and dairy ones are like the big kahuna. We're talking collectively about $1 billion a year. And dairy alone is like a $600 million pot. They are cartoonishly corrupt. There's an insane amount of government accountability reports just talking about fraud with them, abuse. There's hardly any transparency. But I tell this story of how, you know, the got milk, you know, pork the other white meat, these kind of advertising campaigns came out of checkoff. But what the industry realizes, this really didn't spur consumption. So what I argue is you see them slowly transition to manipulating the sciences. So with industrial dairy, their big problem is it's incredibly polluting for the climate. So they want to get ahead of that story. And Vilsack was very key to this. So they took this checkoff money, this tax on farmers to research this. But keep in mind, this is where it's really fascinating to me, really dark. You know, when a dairy cow in Wisconsin's on pasture, you know, when they defecate, they're fertilizing their feed. So, you know, the circle of life. When you put dairy cows inside, not only are you using fossil fuels to grow their feed, when you also pool their manure, that creates additional methane that's not really produced when it defecates on land. So you have all this additional climate change gas being produced. Industry knew it. And so to get ahead of it, it took money tax on family farmers and used it against them to basically try to promote these things called digesters, where essentially you pool the manure and you try to capture the methane gas off of it. So it's incredible. I mean, it's like taking union dues and using it for the corporation. Mm-hmm. It is. And then, I mean, even in my dairy baron, I tell the story how like my dairy baron, he created this milk called Fairlife. He used checkoff dollars to help do that. He created this whole advertising, like this big tourist agricultural tour center advertising his dairy model production. That was used with checkoff dollars. And so, I mean, he literally was taking money from family dairy farms in Wisconsin going broke and using their money against them. And USA did nothing. I mean, that is, and on top of it, this is where Vilsack was a lobbyist for. He was using checkoff money. Vilsack is in the pocket of checkoffs. It is, and to me, it's really filled the void at the private, like for the research that happens at land grants now, where with the privatization of land grants, checkoff dollars have filled that void. So you see all this research coming out of certain land grants saying how great digesters are, you know, ethanol and airplanes, all that kind of garbage. And it's just, it's financing this junk science. So it's really capturing that ecosystem. And so for readers out there, I mean, imagine just reading an article and you see some like tenure named chair in dairy saying how great something is. You know what I mean? It's hard to refute that. And you just don't realize, all that secret money, dark money behind going on. So digesters to me, and it's also this bigger story, and you're seeing a lot of reports come out now, how all Vilsack's effort for the climate stuff in agriculture is just a farce. He's trying to bury ethanol underground, doing ethanol airplanes, these digesters. He's just wasting billions of taxpayer dollars in such a crucial moment in our history. And so that's what that's really about.
Thank you, Austin. Austin Frerich is our guest today, the author of Barons, Money, Power, and the Corruption of America's Food Industry. You can call and join the conversation at 608-256-2001. And we have a good friend and family farmer, Sturman Norman Patterson, has called in and wants to talk with you, Austin. So, Norman, welcome to WORT.
Well, hey, Norman. Thanks for having me. And I'm humbled to be on the radio with such people as Pete, whom I met a few weeks ago on Bert's show. And listening to Austin, I'm impressed. The fact that it took you 5 years to write this book it shows in the completeness of it, even though I haven't read it all. I just acquired it last night, and you're telling me the book just came out today, so I'm not sure how that happened. The neighbor had it, and he'd already read it, and we talked a little bit last night. But anyway, I have a couple of questions that can kind of fold together, maybe. First of all, I live in Evansville, which is going to be seeing a very large soybean processing facility come in. They plan to start building this year, and it's being put in by CHS Cooperative. And I'm wondering how you compare that to the Barrens that you talk about. They plan on processing 70 million bushel a year. Rock County, where it's located, only produces, well, only it's the biggest county in the state for soybean production, but they produce 6 million. So that means a lot of soybeans coming into the area. And just want your thoughts on CHS. And what do us older farmers, I'm going on 70 now, I'm privileged to be managing land that's been in the family since 1868. Unfortunately, I don't know where it's going to be after me, but how do you get older farmers motivated to join your fight, so to speak, against these barons and whatnot? We've seen our local co-op, which is now called Elsevia, has grown and merged and merged and merged over the last, 30, 35 years to where, you know, we used to know everybody that worked at our co-op 40 years ago. We knew every guy from the gas station to the feed floor to whatever they serve. Anyway, how do we, because there's a lot of us out there, and unfortunately the younger generation is kind of tuned into this bigger is better kind of thing. So I, you know, you say we got to fight it, but I just, how?
Those are great questions, Norman.
Yeah, I mean, I would start with the premise, it's not just about the farmer, it's about the whole food system. Those who pick it, process it, transport, cook it, serve it, what have you. People like my mom and dad. My dad's a truck driver, my mom had a bakery. When you start talking that way, that's 1 in 10 Americans. That's why, to me, any reform of the food system really has to be rooted in labor. I mean, those people doing soybeans, those massive operations, what they don't realize is industry will eventually come from them too. I mean, most of that will be robotics pretty soon. I mean, you go to these combine shows now, these things, these $600,000 machines basically drive themselves. I had a Farm Bureau person in Iowa tell me that straight up. The future for them, for Big Ag in Iowa, is Iowa will be 6 towns with a bunch of driverless tractors.
Unbelievable.
I mean, here's the thing. Mm-hmm. That's what they want. I mean,
right.
They're not, but it doesn't have to be that way. I mean, that's
exactly
why I think Wisconsin's such a great place for this. Because, I mean, let me start with by saying, I think the Wisconsin Farmers Union truly is one of the best farm groups in the nation I've seen. They're younger, they're gender balanced. They really understand the labor component. They do a lot of labor organizing historically. You also have a Democrat AG. I mean, that is, never underestimate the power of reaching out to an elected official or a journalist with something you see that's not right. I mean, keep in mind, they have small staff, they're moving a mile a minute. You just reach out and you tell a journalist, hey, I saw this, this is sketchy, this is going on. I mean, my book is built on those stories. It's brave people. I opened my chapter talking about Julie Dunn, this rural Iowa woman fighting against my hog baron. She told me so much. I mean, those people just know, they know where the bodies are buried. And you have a Democrat attorney general, reach out to him and say, this is market power abuse, or this is what's going on. So that's huge. But for locally, to me, yeah, I'm talking about all these big structural things we need to do, change the farm bill, what have you. But never, to me, one of the big things you can do locally is procurement. I mean, just set up your local farmers doing it right with your schools, with the colleges in the nearby area. That really, I mean, those contracts just stabilize families. They're doing it right. I mean, it's also that's good politics, by the way. Who doesn't want all dairy served in Wisconsin? Schools coming from Wisconsin dairy farmers. or I'll be served in the school. I mean, would you want your kids to eat rainforest beef? Or do you want them to have, you know, beef from Wisconsin farmers? I mean, it's just good politics. I'm so playing to it. I mean, it's, you got to do this thing of calling out things, but also playing into the hope. And it's like, you know, even though my book seems a little dark, I think my goal in my book is to, here's what the system is, and here's what it could be.
So Austin, I was impressed with your sort of sociological observation that when companies get bigger and more powerful, they tend to do so at the expense of workers and the communities they operate in. More wealth will leave the places that produced it, and anger will fill the void.
Yeah, that is, this is going to sound weird, Bert. When I love going for road trips. Mm-hmm. I have an old Road Atlas, love my two-lane roads, Great River Road.
Exactly.
But I love when I drive. I love stopping at, I kid you not, casinos, malls, and grocery stores, because it's good people watching. And it was, to me, it was spending time one weekend, maybe 2 years ago, down in Burlington, Keokuk, Iowa, and just kind of seeing what happened to these towns with all these free trade agreements. It just really just, I don't want to say free trade, because that's a BS word.
Right.
But these towns just got hollowed out. I mean, you just hang out in these spaces. Most of these towns, now Walmart is the town square. Downtown died. The mall died. So Walmart is that. And you just kind of, you feel, it's easy to just to like write people off. Oh, they're voting against their economic interests or what have you. Or you can have empathy and understand what happened here. These are all Democrat strongholds, and they no longer are now. And I love talking about this because to me, it taps into anger and it redirects it. Instead of blaming the immigrant, blame JBS. Mm-hmm. You know, it's what Trump is doing is a tale of the oldest time. You know, strong man, blame some minority group for your personal ills, but really is in the pocket of the oligarchs. Like that is, we know how that story plays out in history. And so, you know, how can we all be more like Julie Dunn and speak truth to power?
That's exactly true. We've got just 5 minutes left for you to call in, 608-256-2001, if you want to join the conversation. Austin, let's talk about your last chapter, the conclusions, and your ideas for next steps for people to take. Take it away. Yeah. It's a little bit short here, but...
Yeah. So let me start by saying, to me, one of the best appointments under President Biden has been his appointment of Lina Khan as Commissioner of the Federal Trade Commission. Mm-hmm. This young woman is bringing us back into the era of trust busting. I mean, she has filed anti-monopoly cases against all the big tech companies now. She is like, it's weird to see someone like a living legend, but like she walks into any law school in America and the kids go wild. She's incredible. She's the one that personally stopped, I mean, her agency, she's reframed the way we talk about monopoly in America. She stopped the Albertson Kroger merger, or she's challenging it. And one of the things I talk about in my book is I think we should have an honest conversation over stripping USDA for parts. And one of them is so USDA has antitrust authority, meatpacking. Take it away. Give it to FTC. USDA, to me, is incapable of doing its job. It views itself more as like a chamber of commerce than doing what's best for workers, farmers, and eaters. So that's one thing. The other thing, like I said earlier, is just junking the farm bill. I just think the government shouldn't pick winners and losers in the food system. Just take all that money, put it into conservation programs, let farmers pick what's best for their land. The other thing I would do is focus on the labor stuff. I mean, labor really needs to be the center here. What's best for the meatpacking workers? Like, we saw what good reforms did after the jungle and how we made that into a middle-class profession that really benefited people like my grandpa. My grandpa used to work at a Wilson's hog factory and a slaughterhouse in Cedar Rapids. Mm-hmm. And what's happened is we systematically, policy have decided to, it's returning to that exploitative low-wage occupation that wasn't in the jungle. And then, like I said, procurement, I think that's huge. And then the last thing I would really push your listeners to, especially if you're part of any kind of farm organization, is personnel. Personnel is everything. I mean, go back to the Lena Khan woman I mentioned. That was a group of organizations that really pushed hard for her to get appointed. And now look what we've seen because of that appointment. So like imagine, instead of having these checkoff lobbyists, you know, running USDA, like imagine who it could be. Who could be the undersecretary for conservation, or, you know, the state director for Wisconsin, for USDA, like all this kind of stuff. Personnel is policy. I'm a big, big believer in that. And so, I don't know. it's a lot easier to make reforms if you have people on your side in positions of power versus, you know, industry hacks.
And what are the great organizations? You mentioned Wisconsin Farmers Union. Can anybody join them?
Yeah, anyone can join them. They're actually about to open a new food hall up in Chippewa Falls, which is really exciting.
A food hall?
Yeah. Yeah, where a lot of local farmers will sell their stuff, have a restaurant, I believe. Keep in mind, I toured this maybe a year and a half ago, so things might have changed. Mm-hmm. But I follow their Facebook page, and they're renovating like an old factory in downtown Chippewa. It's they're a really good organization. I mean, I want to live, like, that's the future. Like, people like them, people like Practical Farmers of Iowa, that's the America I want to live in. Mm-hmm. It's like, how do we copy and paste people like that doing it right?
And I think there's a lot of people with a lot of desire to make it better, just looking for the vehicle of how to do it. So
they do.
We've got just a couple minutes left. Austin, take it away. So what haven't we covered? What do people need to know? What are your last thoughts? Because I know today's super busy. You've gotten more than a few interviews, and we are deeply appreciative of you taking an hour of this incredible day when you're releasing
your book. First of all, thank you for having me on. But I would say to your listeners out there, if you found this interesting, please buy the book this week. I'm a first-time author in the book world. There's this notion that books like this don't sell. And my goal, I can be stubborn. I might get that from my mother. But when someone tells me I can't do something, I do it. Mm-hmm. So my goal is to prove people wrong. I'm already incredibly grateful for the press this book has received. It is playing all random corners of America right now. I literally, during our interview, I was going to interrupt you but Drudge Report just posted my book on their website.
Really? Good.
Yeah. So, which is like, that's how you get successful reform movements in American history, is you bring together non-traditional bedfellows. I mean, you have Josh Hawley in Missouri working with Elizabeth Warren on meatpacking right now.
Mm-hmm.
So like, let's kick Vilsack to the curb and put people in who can actually move a football down the field. That said, I do got to let you go, Bert. Is there anything else I can answer for you?
You know, I just want to say thanks. I think there's a lot of hopelessness in some corners of rural America. And I think this book brings some light, some heat, some inspiration, and a bit of a path forward. So, Austin, thank you. And we will see you in person next Tuesday down at Leopold's.
I've never been, but I've heard fantastic things.
It's a great new bookstore. It used to be the Greenbush Bakery. Great donuts to great books. There we are.
Perfect.
So, Austin, have a great day. We'll see you next week. And thanks for being here on WORT.
Yeah, you take care now.
Thanks, Austin. Nice to spend an hour with you. So I would like to also thank Steve out there at the reception desk, and John, the engineer who's made this whole magical happen. Jade, who's in there making sure everything works well, and that she always does. Shali, and I want to thank you. And the callers, y'all are great. So go out and buy Austin Frerich's book, Barons, Money, Power, and the Corruption of America's Food Industry, published by Island Press. And come on down to Leopold's next Tuesday at 6 p.m. And then come home and listen to the news from WRT on the archives. So this is Bert Zipper signing off. Have a great day. Disregard the mainstream media distorted. We come and listen and support it. Don't take no prisoners if you can't afford to feed none. Don't start no fights if you cannot predict the outcome. Don't make donations where you cannot get your dough back. The apathetic bull, to send them all your Prozac. I will not climb into your telephone tree, and hell no, you cannot put me on hold. It's the same recorded message you've been saying all along. Keep handing it.
You're listening to WORT 89.9 FM, Madison.
This is Pacifica Radio's Letters in Politics. On today's show,
the classical definition, and in fact the definition of happiness for most of human history, was almost the opposite. It wasn't feeling good, it was being good. It wasn't the pursuit of immediate pleasure, it was the pursuit of long-term virtue. And it just blew my mind to read the classical and Enlightenment sources that inspired the founders when they wrote that phrase into the Declaration of Independence. And for them, happiness really has to do with self-improvement.
A conversation on the meaning of the phrase, the pursuit of happiness, which is found in the U.S. Declaration of Independence. Our guest is Jeffrey Rosen, president and CEO of the National Constitution Center and the author of the book, The Pursuit of Happiness, How Classical Writers on Virtue Inspired the Lives of the Founders and Defined America. That's next on Letters and Politics. But first, the news.
With the BBC News, President Biden has promised to send all the federal resources necessary to help with recovery after a container ship crashed into a bridge in Baltimore over one of America's busiest shipping lanes. Six people are still unaccounted for after the Francis Scott Key Bridge collapsed. Mr. Biden said his thoughts were with all those caught up in the tragedy.
Our prayers are with everyone involved in this terrible accident and all the families, especially those waiting for the news of their loved one right now. We're incredibly grateful for the brave rescuers who immediately rushed to the scene and to the people of Baltimore who want to say, we're with you. We're going to stay with you as long as it takes. You're Maryland tough, you're Baltimore strong, and we're going to get through this together. And I promise we're not leaving.
The U.S. Supreme Court appears unlikely to restrict access to the widely used abortion drug mifepristone. At a hearing, a majority of justices expressed skepticism about the arguments presented by anti-abortion groups. Nita Taufik reports.
This is a case that could have serious implications for reproductive rights, given mifepristone was used in nearly two-thirds of all abortions in the U.S. last year, but also for the regulation of other medicines and products. It's the first known case to call into question the Federal Food and Drug Administration's authority. The court must decide whether the FDA's decision to allow the pill to be sent in the post and to be used to end pregnancies of up to 10 weeks rather than 7 was lawful. But before that, the justices today had to consider whether